We are live. Jim Hunter, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Jordan, thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor.
All right. Again, you have been a good friend. We met each other at church, and then you've since gone on to help start a church. So why don't you introduce yourself for those who aren't familiar with who you are and what you do?
Sure. Jim Hunter was born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama. Grew up in a Christian home. I grew up kind of a Episcopresby because my mom was born and raised Episcopalian. Both sets of my grandparents were Episcopalian. And then my dad was Presbyterian.
Okay.
As I've said to you and to many others, if there's such a thing as a high Presbyterian church, that was my home church. I was baptized there. I was confirmed there, and I was actually married there. And the name of the church is Independent Presbyterian in Birmingham. Tragically, it's gone the way of the woke world, and it's a disaster. Truly tragically.
Yeah.
But if one was to go to the church, you would swear it was built in the 16th century with the
wow,
you know, three or four stories high in terms of the ceiling of the church, the stained glass windows, the pipe organ, mm-hmm. absolutely beautiful.
Yeah,
I had a call to ministry when I was 7 years old. I went wow. majored in religion at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. I thought I was going to go straight to seminary, but by the time I graduated in mid 85, it was all the woke tares among the wheat was always already obvious. Mm. And I was at that point, I'm like, well, what am I going to do? I didn't know enough about the continuing movements of the Episcopal Church. I knew the PCA because the PCA flagship church, Briarwood, is in Birmingham.
Yeah.
However, if you went back and talked to those particular guys at the time, they would tell you things like, well, we're really four-point Calvinists. Mm. They were, and I'm not saying that to be ugly. I'm just saying that's how they viewed the world.
Sure.
And it was very much of a Billy Graham's got it right and kind of the every Sunday is a altar call Billy Graham crusade.
Okay.
Well, that to me, relative to historical Reformed Presbyterian Episcopalian faith was just wasn't the same thing.
Sure.
So I wasn't really attracted there. Mm-hmm. And that ended up leading to kind of the what is quote unquote the continuing Episcopal Church. I got involved with a small traditional Episcopal church in Point Clear, Alabama in 1988 when I was getting my MBA at Auburn University. So how did I go from going to seminary to MBA? Well, because I wasn't sure, all right, well, what flight path should I be on? Because I'm not okay with women elders. I'm not okay with all the things that were going on. So I figured, well, until I could find a flight path forward, the other thing God put in me was a love of economics.
Mm.
And we didn't have a minor program at Rhodes, but if we had had one, I would have minored in econ.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to, until the dust settles, the smoke clears, I'm going to go get the MBA, and then I can at least underwrite myself if I need to do something with a continuing church. So because my parents had moved to Point Clear, that's how I got to know the continuing Episcopal Church. That got me involved with the 39 Articles of Religion, which I didn't know about until that time. The old prayer, the prayer book, 1928 and prior, because I then learned what a travesty the 1979 Book of Common Prayer was. It essentially bulldozed the entire, Christian history of the Episcopal Church.
Jim, do me a favor, because we have a lot of people who do not know any of this history. So maybe give like a 5 minute intro to the Episcopal Church, and then you can kind of define some of the, like the 39 articles. What those are.
So all the Episcopal Church is the Church of England in the United States. The Episcopal means a bishop, a bishopric of bishops, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And so that's all it is. But if you look at the what were the grounding documents of the Church of England? What's typically thought of today is, oh, well, Episcopalians are kind of like diet Catholics, Catholic lights, the Catholic Church without the Pope and that sort, which is a fair assessment of what, if you go to a typical Episcopal church today, even those that are quote unquote traditional, what you'll end up finding is what is would be termed an Anglo-Catholic church, which is, it really does seem like it looks, feels, sounds, everything about it is like a quote unquote traditional Catholic church, with the exception of Mary, you know, well, actually in some of them there, I'd say are some Mariology, et cetera. But the actual Protestant grounding of the whole Church of England was not about Henry VIII. It was about Thomas Cranmer, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had traveled to the continent at the end of Henry's reign, beginning of Edward VI's reign. And he finds, he talks to Luther. He talks to Cal. He figures out what's going on. He comes back to England as a changed man. And Edward, so he worked with the young Edward VI, and that's where the 39 Articles of Religion come from. If you read those, which are 100 years older than the Westminster Confession, there's no doubt the Westminster divines are looking at the 39 Articles going, okay, well, we need to expand here, expand there, you know, et cetera. But that's where it all comes from. And up to really the mid-19th century, turn of the 19th to the 20th, it is part, the Church of England or the Anglican Communion around the world, which it's not a coincidence that the King James Bible, the Church of England, is the Bible and the church that follows the empire around the world, the empire upon which the sun never sets. And so, you know, that's, but by the time you get to the late 19th century, some listeners may be familiar with J.C. Ryle, John Charles Ryle, one of the great Protestant Church of England bishops. He was a bishop of Liverpool. Today, by Anglo-Catholics, he's degraded as a Presbyterian with a prayer book. And that's, and that's pretty much what I am, is a Presbyterian with a prayer book, because I think the beauty, the incredible power of what was written in the Book of Common Prayer, and which did go all over the world, and the succinctness of the 39 Articles, which are hammering of the on the errors of the Catholic Church, but they don't do things like go so far as call the Pope the Antichrist. Or really get bulldozer-ish as the Westminster and arguably the 1689 London Confession does as well. So, but that's the general background. John J.C. Ryle, if you have not read him, if you're a listener, you should read this guy. You would swear he wrote the stuff he wrote last week. I mean, unless you pick up here or there, a timing giveaway, you really would think he wrote it very recently. And but that is, in general, that's where God has put my heart. That's what needs to be recreated. I was in the CREC for a long time because I thought that was the flight path. Yes, I departed the CREC, but in terms of, that's not an ugly departure. It's a, I love all these guys. It's just God's called me a different direction.
Yeah. And again, there's so much more we can say on that front, but I mean, just the Episcopalian Church, like there's many people throughout the history of the United States have been part of the Episcopalian Church, many names that people would recognize, even if they wouldn't affiliate them with the church. So good on you. Glad there's people trying to recover, you know, what the good that's there and reject a lot of the insanity that's come to dominate it. But let's go from talking about, from that, which would be an incredible episode. Maybe we do that sometime in the future. We want to talk about gold. So obviously let me just take a peek here. Let's see what do you have the spot price of gold? It looks like $4,344. As at the time of this recording. So this is obviously a little different than things were about, you know, 6 months ago, a year ago, Jim. Things have gotten kind of crazy in gold world. So I'm sure this is not surprising to you. We've had a bunch of conversations. And there's other people who, again, would be surprised to hear about a conversation about gold on a Bitcoin podcast, because they would assume that we are mortal enemies. between the digital and analog realms. And so we would love to disappoint them, the two of us, because we did a debate together, hosted by the Cross Politic program out in Moscow, Idaho. The two of us got out there and we were debating with another guy who was representing the traditional, again, hilariously titled traditional finance world, less than 100 years old, but sure, it's traditional. And so we get out there, and to much of the surprise and possible chagrin of the entire audience, you and I just went back and forth defending each other the whole time. I wanted to have you on. It's, you know, Gold's doing super well. And so I want to come kind of have you on here and just kind of have you make the Christian case for Gold to our audience. A lot of them, again, are already Gold appreciators. But I would love for you to kind of talk about that. So again, you've already mentioned how you got into economics, your interest there. How did you come to be interested in and see the value of gold?
So when I went to school between my, and I started at Auburn University in their MBA program in the fall of 1987. That was almost simultaneous with when one of the Board of Trustees member, John Denton, opened Auburn to the Ludwig von Mises Institute. The only reason Ludwig von Mises Institute is at Auburn is because of this guy, John Denton, who was on the Board of Trustees. So it's kind of odd, you know, why in the world are these free market gold guys, you know, Austrian economics guys in Auburn, Alabama, but that's why.
Yep.
And now they've built their own campus. It's a great building, et cetera. But as a result, I had some professors that were very friendly with the von Mises Institute. So that's how I learned about, the reason the Austrians like it is because they want free markets. And part of the whole way the free markets work is limited government. Yep. How do you limit government? You do not let government, you tie the hands of government from doing what we've been doing since we got off the gold standard in August 1971, and they go absolutely hog wild and print money ex nihilo and print credit ex nihilo. And so that's where I was introduced to, this is the philosophical rationale for why you want to have it. And that's 87, so I'm only 16 years after they had gotten off the gold standard at that point. I also am at school when you had the October 19th, 1987 crash. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting, down 22% a day.
Yep.
And of course, we've never seen that low again. And part of the reason we haven't is because of this credit creation ex nihilo.
Jim, let me just interrupt you. I was instructed, I was told, and under the assumption that the stock market is never that volatile. I mean, that's only Bitcoin volatility, 22% in one day.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it certainly happens, and it can certainly happen again. There are all kinds of other truths you've probably been told, like housing prices in the United States never go down.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. You're right.
Yeah.
Never forget that one, too. Uh-huh. So that's where I get introduced to it. I spent most of my career until the last 9 years was in institutional fixed income, which means I was a bond trading and sales for Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, that side of Wall Street. And then from 2005 to 2010, I had a hedge fund, which was a structured credit hedge fund, which if you have seen the movies The Big Short, mm-hmm. or Margin Call, either one of those, they both of them did a superb job of like actually telling you this is what it really was like. Margin Call in particular, the boardroom scene in Margin Call is absolutely 100% real life. They nailed it. Yeah. And but we were the Big Short, except we weren't short mortgages. We were short investment grade credit.
Okay.
But we did very well because obviously if you were short in those years, your fund did superbly. But it was being in the middle of that huge conflagration and watching how it was actually dealt with. I mean, I had a front row seat to this. Why? Because our counterparties for our fund were Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, and Bank of America before Bank of America and Merrill Lynch were shotgun wedding together.
Yeah.
Lehman Brothers was basically, if you want to think about it, it was almost like a mob hit. You know, this is a mob. We don't want to deal with Dominic anymore. So he's gone, and they smoked them.
Yep.
But if you go back and look at what should have actually come to pass, given what are rules of capital, what are if you're insolvent, it's too bad. You bet and you lost and you lose. Well, except that's not what happened. Yep. What happened was Goldman still exists. Yep. JP Morgan still exists. Citibank, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, all these firms still exist. And what should have happened to them all is, if you're familiar with the movie Trading Places, this is an old movie with Eddie Murphy. It's a comedy.
Yeah, that was the one that came to mind, but I was like, wait, it can't be that one.
Yes, it is that one, because if you get the serious part of Trading Places is at the end, after they come out of the orange juice pits, and they say margin call boys, and the two Duke brothers who have tried to illegally corner the market with inside info. They go, you know perfectly well we don't have $394 million in cash. So the guy says, okay, sell all assets of Duke and Duke Commodity Brokers and sell their seats.
Mm.
The brothers go crazy and say, you can't do that. We founded this exchange. This thing is ours. Well, that what they were is what Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan were doing at the time.
Yeah.
And of course, so why didn't that happen? Because you've got congressmen and senators who don't know which way is up. They sent Ben Bernanke, who works for them, as the head of the Federal Reserve, and that's still true today. The Fed works for City of London, Wall Street banks, Rothschilds, and some other. And this isn't like, you know, tin foil hats, secret inside information. You can go look this up on the internet. They send Bernanke in. They send him in with Hank Paulson.
Yeah.
Was there any conflict of interest between the fact that Hank Paulson was Treasury Secretary and he had been Goldman Sachs CEO?
Surely not. Surely not, James.
Not a shred of So anyway, and basically they tell the congressman, if you don't give us what we want, if you go back and you can watch the hearings, they essentially say, if you don't give us what we want, we're probably going to have tanks in the streets of New York tomorrow.
Yep.
The congressmen don't know which way is up.
Yeah.
Then, just like they don't know which way is up now.
Correct.
And they basically gave them everything they wanted.
Yeah. All they know is that if the stock market goes apocalyptic on their watch, they're going to get voted out and blamed for it. And so it's all self-protection. It's horrible.
Correct. Correct.
And here's a question for you, just real quick. So I just want to go back to what you said about you being short institutional credit. So obviously you have guys like Steve Eisman, the whole Big Short crew. These guys are digging into Michael Burry. They're digging into to mortgages, and buying up mortgage-backed securities because they're realizing this is a house of cards. What were you seeing in institutional credit that allowed you to kind of go short and profit from what you saw?
Sure. Okay. Well, my hedge fund was myself and my partner, my Christian brother, and both of us had come out of Wall Street. He was institutional fixed income derivatives, and I was institutional fixed income cash.
Mm.
Both of us were saying, yeah, we knew mortgages were a disaster too.
Yeah.
The question was, if our firm is two guys in Fairhope, Alabama, with a couple of Bloomberg screens, how are we going to, we cannot be wrong.
Yeah.
We can be wrong, but we're a little wrong. We can't be a lot wrong.
Yeah.
In the Big Short film, Michael Burry, the character played by the guy who was Batman.
Christian Bale. Yeah.
Christian Bale.
Yeah.
The Christian Bale character, he's really wrong and he's really, really bad down.
Yeah.
And there's a scene in the film where the guys are like, you can't do this. He's like, well, I'm going to get even more long.
Yeah.
Or I'm getting even more short.
He was down hundreds and a couple hundred million bucks at one point or something.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Correct. Well, we couldn't afford to do that. We couldn't, in a percentage basis, we never had that sort of capital under management. But we felt like our absolute maximum downside was something like 30%.
Okay.
But we were looking at whether it was more, where any sort of credit, because the Federal Reserve had killed interest rates to zero.
Yep.
1%. You know, there was no, it was ridiculous. These are not real interest rates. These are concocted, just like they have been all this time. And we looked at investment grade credit. And at the time, if I had a triple A U.S. government and I sold that and bought a triple B, I was only going to get paid 30 basis points to do it. Well, then what's the normal relationship? It's 110.
Oh my gosh.
So it's like, this is stupidity. I mean, unless you're talking about a robust Christian moral nation and universities that are pumping out, this is
every vials left and right.
And you look on what the actual culture was and you're like 30 basis points for that swap.
Yeah.
And we've got debt out our eyeballs. I mean, this doesn't make any sense. So how do you, instead, if you couldn't do mortgages because you can't afford being wrong, you do investment grade credit. Because if you're 30 basis points, triple B to triple A, how bad can that get? Can it go to parity? So maybe it was so crazy, maybe it could, but fortunately, obviously it didn't, and we did well.
Yeah.
But that was, it was the same thing. Credit has been ballooned up, just whether it's mortgage credit, investment grade credit, high yield bond credit, whatever the credit was, it was silly because the Federal Reserve had killed all yield. So if I'm a Japanese pension fund and I got 0% there, I got 0% in the treasuries, give me any yield anywhere of any sort because I've got to pay my retirees.
Exactly.
That was a trade to be sure.
Okay, so were you aware of Eismann? Like, did you know him, or like, were you aware of those guys and the trade that they were putting on, or not really? Because I know there were people who knew about it who thought they were nuts. There were other people who just never knew about it. So, kind of, you know, in your case, you said we couldn't afford to be wrong. So, maybe it was just it just didn't fit given your risk profile and, you know, the funds under management, that kind of stuff.
It was, yes, we did know of him.
Okay,
and we certainly knew of Michael Burry.
Yep.
We had also known of guys that got carried out on a stretcher who were right. You know, they were right, but they put the trade on in 04.
Yeah. Sometimes having those, you know, having the wrong timing is indistinguishable from being wrong. That whole
correct.
Timing.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
And so yes, we knew of them. The wrong part was that, again, a Michael Burry with that much institutional credibility. Now, we had institutional credibility as on the bond desk that we were on.
Yeah.
We did not have institutional credibility when we created a fund, a brand new fund in Fairhope, Alabama.
Sure.
That's what I mean. Because when you go into an institutional guy and say, well, we want to compete to manage your money, he's looking at us like, wait a second, I got five guys in New York and 10 in Chicago. Why am I
doing with you?
Right.
Yeah,
and that's how we competed.
I think you said this. But what year did you leave New York and then move to Fairhope?
I never went to New York. I was always in I started in Mobile, Alabama, went to Birmingham at a Shearson Lehman office. Then I was in Atlanta for 5 years with Marilyn Lehman.
Okay.
When my daughter was born in 98, we moved back to Fairhope.
Got it.
I worked for a regional firm until 05, and then I had the hedge fund 05 to 2010.
Okay. So you guys do well on that trade. You know, you guys are looking like geniuses. You know, you're maybe not making Michael Burry money, but you're still doing great. So then, you know, was it a direct jump to, you know, go into gold, starting Alp and going into gold or no?
It wasn't direct. The first thing that happened was the other way we competed was to say, if you come to us and ask for liquidity, we're going to give it to you. So for instance, one of our biggest accounts was a university. We were the only hedge fund that was up, and we were also the only hedge fund that wasn't gating. What in the world's a gate? A gate means I, as the hedge fund manager, can say, you can't take your money out because if you do, it'll adversely affect the fund.
Sure.
So I am quote unquote throwing the gates up so you can't pull your money out. Or other guys would say force majeure, which is a law term saying something has happened, force majeure, a majority force, something so great that quote unquote, we couldn't have anticipated, therefore we're not going to give you your money back.
Yeah.
So here comes the school going, you're the only people giving us liquidity and you're the only people that up. We don't want to take the money away from you, but we have no choice.
Yeah.
So we maxed out at about $35 million in assets under management.
Okay.
By the time we get to like mid 09, we were down to 4.
Wow.
Now here, we're sitting there going, wait a minute, we didn't do anything long. We did everything we said we were going to do. Yeah. And we've lost all our AUM.
Yep.
And it then I'll give you a little vignette. In the fourth quarter of 08, Merrill Lynch is one of our counterparties. We don't have to get too far in the weeds about, you know, how to swap contracts work, et cetera. But suffice it to say, every quarter there was a payment that either we owed Merrill or Merrill owed us. Well, Merrill did owe us at the end of the where the book settled up at September 30. Essentially, we're on the phone with this guy that's the payments guy at Merrill. And he, long story short, he's basically asking for a day or two to send us the money he owed us. Oh, all right. Now, this is Merrill Lynch,
yeah.
Pierce, Spinner, and Smith in New York City. The amount of money they owed us should have been in a, you know, cigar box behind somebody's
desk. Exactly. Yeah. In the
and we're like,
cushions.
Right. You cannot be serious that y'all are, you know, you owe us and you need to pay it. And a lot of, you know, and they did send us the money. But the whole idea that we were having the conversation was crazy.
Yes. Did you guys go more short?
Well, we certainly kept the shorts we had on.
Yeah.
But we were really, at that time, we were more concerned of, are we going to be able to get the principal back to our clientele?
Sure, yeah.
So we didn't want to go too crazy. You know, you're in no man's land.
Yeah.
If we demand the money from Merrill and close all the swaps, will they actually do it?
Yep.
Right? It was when you hear the war stories of what was going on, it was a wild time.
Yep. Yep.
Well, fast forward the clock about 9 months into mid 09.
Mm-hmm.
Same guy from Merrill Lynch. Now he's Merrill Lynch Bank America. Now my partner and I are trying to re-raise assets under management because now we want to go long risk because we're seeing what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, they're basically making it. There's no way they're going to let the credit market they will inflate they'll make phony money. That way the bond payments will get made. So we want to be long risk now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we go to Merrill Lynch, the swap guy, the payments guy, the same guy who's begging for more time. And all of a sudden we got totally different attitude. Now, what do you guys want to do? You know, so we explain, and he's like, well, how many assets under management do you have? And we're like, time out. We made every payment in the worst part of 08. We never were a problem.
Yeah.
What difference does it make to you about how many assets? Oh, I'm sorry. You know, if you got a quarter billion, we got nothing to do here.
Oh my gosh.
And we're like looking at each other. This is as rich as you can get.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that we did everything right. We gave liquidity. We come back to it. Counterparty we were never a problem to and told, sorry, you don't get to play.
Yeah. Yep.
And to this day, what do we got? Jamie Dimon running around in private jets, being important, making big speeches. So, and as well as all these other guys at firms that should have been shuttered. So basically, guy came out of that like, wait, this whole thing is so corrupt.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything in the Bible. I don't know anything in history where you do the sort of things that have been done here, where the piper doesn't end up coming back for his bill.
Yep.
So that, and then all of what I'd learned at Auburn all through the years, that gold was one thing that didn't. And then if you go to our website, you'll see one of the quotes I have up there is Genesis chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. Mm. River runs out of Eden. The name of the first river is Pisah. It goes into the land of Havilah, and there is gold in that land, and the gold of that land is good. Why on earth is God telling us pre-fall about gold being in some land? Mm-hmm. What is he doing?
Yeah.
Well, we find out because wisdom is better than fine gold. We were going to burn the dross off the silver to make you better. Oh, okay. It's going to become this standard. Mm-hmm. Well, not only is it a standard for biblical truths, it also becomes, as we know from the history of the world, it becomes the standard for what is a unit of account, medium of exchange, and store of labor, and a store of value, and most importantly, a store of labor. Mm-hmm. That is what gold was then, is now, and I truly believe until the Lord returns, it will continue to have that role.
Yeah. And I have a buddy who's also into Bitcoin, and we have this debate. We had this on a podcast not too long ago where he just basically was like talking about Bitcoin demonetizing gold. And I'm just like, listen, I could see it happening in limited, you know, amounts. I just don't see it happening over like a 1,000-year period or something like that. I could see it happening to some degree, but I just think given the nature of things, I just think gold's going to be around a lot longer. You know, I just think it's this foolish thing. It's this quote unquote dumb rock. And yet, you know, there's still going to be there for people all over the world. You know, it's been around for, you know, thousands of years. It's still going to be around for a long time. I don't see any any chance of it just going away. Absolutely. Okay, so let's kind of get into some of the things that, you know, like when you talk to people. So obviously, as part of the reason for this podcast is to facilitate conversations about Bitcoin with a couple different audiences, or rarely three, but we'll talk about two of them for right now. One of them is Christians who are into Bitcoin. So we want to, you know, a lot of them who have gotten into Bitcoin and find value in Bitcoin, they started out as gold people. Like they valued, and a lot of the reasons why they value Bitcoin is because of these principles that they first found in gold, and they found through Austrian economics and this kind of thing. The second group, and so those people are much more kindred spirits, I would say, with you, just, you know, very in a manner similar to the way that I am with you. The second group would be Christians who are not yet into Bitcoin. That's who we're, you know, creating this podcast for. And so I would imagine that most of that same audience, that group of people, they would also be very skeptical about the role of gold and the value of gold, because they've been gaslit by a lot of these investment firms and guys like Dave Ramsey and, Dave Bonson as well. And, you know, a lot of these other people into thinking that, oh, gold is just some dumb rock. You know, we should just put our money into the stock market. It's going to give you, you know, guaranteed returns, zero risk, basically. You know, they would see these things like this. And so I would love for, you know, just for you to give you kind of a wide berth here to make the case for why, you know, why these guys are wrong and why Christians who take their faith seriously should think differently about gold. So you have the floor.
Okay, thanks, Jerry. But just to clarify, what's the third group? You said,
yeah. So the third group, and this is again, you'll understand. So the third group are people who are into, for our audiences, people who are into Bitcoin who are not yet Christians, and so for them, we're trying to quote unquote Jesus pill them, show them the value proposition of Jesus, because they already get the value proposition of Bitcoin. So continue.
All right. So why are you and I not quote unquote mortal enemies, as you said when we started? Because we have to get to the essence of what both of these things are.
Yeah.
Gold is a gold and Bitcoin share the most crucial element, which is I have the ability to have liquid money that is not contained within a corrupt financial system.
Yeah, there's no counter.
That is what they share. And that is free. I don't care about dollar price. I don't care about volatility. I don't care about any of that in comparison to the central role they hold. Mm-hmm. So if I can accomplish having the ability to have liquid money outside the system, well, why should I care whether it's Bitcoin or gold? Well, there are reasons to have both of them, and I have both of them. Mm-hmm. I have both of them because Bitcoin unquestionably is because of blockchain technology, the fact that it is absolute dead cold. It cannot grow to any more than 21 million Bitcoin, some number. The supply constraint, that's beautiful. That is what is gold. Well, there's only so much of it that's ever been mined, period. There's only so much of it in the Earth's crust, period. Mm-hmm. The only real supply concern you might have going forward would be mining gold on asteroids or other planets. I mean, that's a real thing going forward, but we're still a fair amount of ways from that, where you begin to materially impact the supply.
Sure.
And we don't even know. Okay, well, we assume that there's gold on asteroids, But what is the cost of trying to get it off an escrow?
Exactly.
It's pretty bad here. So both of them have natural supply constraints. Mm-hmm. That's how you handcuff politicians who don't know what supply constraint means.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I was trying to take away from them the ability to they no longer can create as much money as they want to. The amount of money in the system is no longer beholden to or no longer basically able to be dictated by a group of people in the same way as it can be with gold or with Bitcoin.
They can print all the money they want, but since they cannot control the price of Bitcoin, fine, print it all you want. Well, Bitcoin's going to go to 500,000.
Yep.
I mean, it's that simple.
Yep.
So there's the handcuff element of it. The gold part of it is, well, why hasn't gold done this a long time ago? Well, then we got to get into what are the elements of the pricing mechanism for gold. Well, a lot of it has to do with the futures market.
Yep.
And the futures market and the gold lending market, all of this is right out of Chicago and London.
Yep.
There is hyper geopolitical government pressure and participation in those markets that have kept gold from blasting through the to the moon.
And talk about that a little bit. What are some of those pressures, and why is it that governments want to suppress the price of gold, and what have been the mechanisms? You mentioned the futures market, but how else did they suppress the market?
The lending of gold and silver they don't have. Okay. So like what is going on right this minute is, if it doesn't take much, just look at the financial literature of the last week or so. What's been one of the stories? LBMA, London billion banks don't have the silver to deliver versus those future contracts.
Yeah.
Now, typically in the past, you had a bunch of financial institutions that were all involved. They're not going to take delivery, so it doesn't matter. And we can move the price around with just flood the futures market with, I want to. Open interest it's going to cost the government so much, but it doesn't matter because it'll suppress the price of silver, suppress the price of gold. And that's more important to us than whatever we might lose on a given trade.
Sure.
And does Wall Street and Chicago and London like that? Sure, that's business. That means, we're writing tickets left, right, and center with these crazy people from a central bank or a government. What do we care? We're making money on the trade. That all works until something happens. To me, the most important event over the last 5 years was the confiscation of the Russian foreign reserves.
February 2022? Is that what that was?
I think so.
Yeah.
And when you do that, the whole world goes, are you seriously telling me that those guys just took $300 billion of your reserves that were in their financial system?
Mm.
And said, sorry, you don't get to have them anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if that's the rules of the game, then I'm changing. I'm going to go change what I'm doing. I cannot trust the Western governments and their banking system.
Yep.
And if I can't trust them, what can I trust?
Yep.
What do you have? What are the BRICS doing right now?
Yep.
They are very, very focused on physical gold and don't take my word for it. Go look on the internet and go look at who has been making these major purchases of gold. Mm-hmm. Certainly over the last, three or four years,
yep.
But go back to the turn of the century with the .com stuff, mm-hmm. meltdown of Enron, meltdown of WorldCom, all 08. It's the Russian central bank. It's the Chinese central bank.
Yep.
And these are huge buyers.
Yep.
So why is this taking so long? It's taken a while for the system to actually get to the point where it's like, oh my gosh, we're actually going to have to come up with this, what we promised we had, and we actually don't have it.
Yeah.
So I think that's the major driver of silver prices right now. It doesn't mean that we can't have a 20% sell off.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean whether gold or silver. But I would tell you, that I think until you get some material, I mean really, really material change of government and government spending, deficit spending, then if you go back and look at the historical relationship between the price of gold and how much credit has been created by the United States for that equilibrium to be right. Yeah, I wrote a piece in 2019 before all the COVID insanity of credit creation. And at that time, the right number solved for X was $7,000 an ounce. That would balance the historical relationship between the amount of the gold, the market value of the gold owned by the United States and our credit issuance.
Yeah.
Well, now that number's larger. So what's the equilibrium number? It's a five-figure number. I don't know what that five-figure number is precisely, but that's what it would be. So, oh my gosh, I missed it at 40, what did you say, 4,300?
Yeah, 4,300 some.
You know, if you don't own any, you need to own some now. The Bitcoin, same thing.
Yeah.
If you don't own any Bitcoin, you need to own some now.
Yeah.
If you've got some, sure, you can, then you can fiddle around with, well, I'm going to wait till gold trades at 3,500 and I'll buy some more. I need Bitcoin at 75,000. Yeah.
Yeah.
If and only if you already own it. If you don't own it, today is the day you need to
play. Today's a great, So, okay, so talk to us, because I remember one of the most shocking moments of my entire life happened sometime in the last 5 years, probably in the last two or three, when I found out that the United States has marked their, like, is valuing their gold at like $40 an ounce. Can you speak to that? Why? Like, how did that happen? How is that? That makes no sense. I know the United States weren't alone in doing that. So if you can kind of unpack why that was the case and why that's still the case today.
Well, it actually was accurate, right? Until August 1571, because it was Bretton Woods. It was agreed upon $40 an ounce dollar price. Mm-hmm. And that was going to be the lock-in for around the world. Everybody could trust that price, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Again, United States, Nixon. August 15th, 71 says, we're just kidding about trading gold for dollars.
Yeah.
What? You know, that's right up there with, we're just going to take $300 billion of Russian foreign reserves.
Sure.
Same sort of world changing. This, we're in a different, totally different world now. That's what happened in August 71. So on the books, if you look at, say, July of 71, the United States has 8,200 tons of gold at $42 an ounce. Therefore, the asset is worth this. Why did they never change the dollar price of how they carried it on the books? I think there are various and sundry explanations to that. My general explanation is kind of the Warren Buffett, David Bonson, what's the guy in Nashville again?
Ramsey.
Yeah, Dave Ramsey.
Yep.
Come on, that was a long time ago. Yeah, sure, it's nice for historical look, but let's get serious. We're in the 21st century.
Lewis would call this chronological snobbery, is what you're saying.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I have asked the Fight Laugh Feast guys, and I'd ask anybody. Mm-hmm. I'm not, David Bonson is a Christian brother. Dave Ramsey is a Christian brother. Mm-hmm. I would love to be on a stage and debate them anywhere, anytime. and now, of course, they're going to have, I don't know what they're going to say now. Yeah. I mean, their advice was terrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrible.
Hey, bring your Bitcoin little brother with you too. When you get on that stage, okay?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay.
So that's going on. So they just decide to peg it at $40, okay? And that initially, now again, you could argue that's even dubious, because then you go back to 1913, you go back to these different points where they've pegged the dollar to a certain ratio of gold. Even that's totally arbitrary. Like, none of that is based in reality. It's, again, it's a government or a financial institution trying to exercise a level of control that only belongs to God, you know, in order to set a price for purposes that basically are convenient for them. That's really what this is. But so every other country, though, even since 1971, has since marked their gold to market. What is the market price? What is the motivation for the United States to be kind of the lone outlier, or at least one of the lone outliers who have not yet valued their gold to the market price?
Again, I think it's really the mindset has to been to get rid of it and to not elevate it to its proper position.
Sure.
And I think that's changing. I think that the Trump and Bessent are going to market to market. And
really?
Today, that's a matter of time.
Yeah.
I don't know what their agenda is, but you can sort of see as they've gone forward since he got there in January of 2020, mm-hmm. they're figuring out what they need to do.
Yeah.
What's next, and that's going to be one of the next things to happen, because you're going to talk about an asset that will be a $1 trillion asset.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you really let it go, and imagine moving the decimal point one to the right, so
yeah.
It's not 4,200, it's 42,000.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the U.S. has a $10 trillion asset.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. If I've got a $10 trillion asset versus the debt pile I have, now the debt pile doesn't look so
exactly
hopelessly impossible.
Yep.
So
yeah, this has been something that has been talked about, we could just revalue gold. Guys like Luke Groman have talked about this. The United States could just revalue gold to $50,000 an ounce. And then all of a sudden it's totally ridiculous and arbitrary. It would at least conceptually on paper, make their debts not look as bad. And so that would be to try to buy back some credibility,
Right. Well, and I don't want to just arbitrarily revalue it, but when I say let it go, what I mean is let the market actually figure out what this thing is worth.
Yep.
And I think if you do that, and again, go back to the what historically has been the relationship between what the dollar price of gold is and the amount of credit that has been issued by the United States.
Yep.
Let that market price clear.
Yep.
And right now, I think that market price clears, I would guess, more along the lines of the $15,000 to $20,000 an ounce.
Yeah.
And that assumes no more going forward.
Yep.
And since I can't make that assumption based on any, even with Trump, right?
Yeah.
Do I think Trump and Bessent are doing some good things? Here's why I really think they're going to let gold's price go, is because they do want to do some things that would require more government spending.
Yep.
Maybe, arguably, in the long run, they actually are going to shut Washington down.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if that actually really came to pass, then Bitcoin and gold are going to go down in dollar price, right?
Yeah,
I mean they're gonna because it's they're actually financially responsible,
fiscally responsible. Yeah,
yeah,
but they're
right.
Yeah, but then you're like, all right, is this going to be allowed to happen? Because if you actually drain the swamp, there's so many of these people who. I mean, so many departments and so many of these different things that have just all of their incentives are to keep that thing open and for business, even though, again, we all know it's doomed over the long term, over the long haul.
Right.
I mean, Bessent is an interesting figure for those. I mean, I'm guessing most people know this, but Bessent made his nickel helping George Soros short the pound. So if there's somebody who understands what it what's required to basically take down a humongous global dominating currency unit, to see the writing on the wall, his friendliness with Bitcoin has always fascinated me since I heard about it, because you just think about if he sees this thing going down, he basically sees there's no hope for this thing, then he's an interesting person. He's got institutional knowledge that few others would have. So yeah, I would imagine he'd be long gold too.
Yes, he is. He's personally long, and he's an advocate for both Bitcoin and gold in the White House, and he's the Secretary of the Treasury.
Yeah, yeah. So again, guys like Bonson, guys like Ramsey, again, we talked about this. These are not first principles thinkers when it comes to money and economics. They're great, brilliant guys on a whole host of other points. They're expert system gamers. Like they've figured out, hey, this is the system that's been in place for 50 years. The problem though is when you confuse that for having some sort of first principles knowledge of the world over a much longer time horizon and how and why it's worked the way that it's worked. And so I think this is the blind spot that they have and the trap that they've fallen into. And by extension, a lot, they're bringing a lot of people with them.
Correct. Absolutely.
So what, you know, what are some of the things that you, or some of the kind of your approaches for having this conversation with people? I'm sure, again, just like with Bitcoin, the best argument is just the price. for a lot of people, seeing its price go up is the thing that gets their attention. But what are some of the other conversations that you have with people, you know, to try to help them see the value proposition of gold over the long time horizon?
Sure. So, so the two, you and I did the, podcast, whatever it was, debate with Grosspolitik in April in Moscow.
Yep.
And prior to that, in September of 23, I did just a Grosspolitik show.
That's right.
And my, my point then was like, do not get spooled up about what the dollar price is of these assets.
Yep.
What you're, the most important thing, especially for a individual Christian, an individual Christian or individual Christian family to whom God has bequeathed a lot of material worldly wealth, or certainly Christian churches that have giant cash balances.
Mm.
Now, all three of those entities, and they can be small. I don't care about the size so much. The only reason size matters is because if you're somebody that has a material impact on the culture, and you have all of your assets sitting in the system, you're a fool. And I mean that you're being a fool if you think, what happens if Trump doesn't come back? Yes. Do you think these orcs, these Antifa orcs, are going to spend 5 seconds thinking about the sanctity of your cash balance in a bank? No, they're going to figure out how to take it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what does gold and Bitcoin do? It allows you to lower the risk of that sort of event occurring. What are you talking about, Jim? That's ridiculous. That'll never happen. Go look at what happened in 2013 on the island of Cyprus. Mm-hmm. Cyprus is an EU member. Mm-hmm. Their two banks were functionally insolvent because their core asset was Greek sovereign debt, AAA rated by every rating agency, and they were trading at 30 or 40 cents on the dollar. You know anything about fractional reserve banking? If you have your core asset is at 30 cents on the dollar, you are insolvent.
Yeah.
That means you can't pay your depositors what you owe them. They went to the ECB. You're going to have to help us out. The ECB, which essentially is the Germans, said, no, we're not going to do it. Well, what are we supposed to do? What you're going to do is you're going to bail in your depositors. Well, what does that mean? That means that if it's any amount over the insured amount, which over there, I think it's 100,000 euros.
Yeah.
Any amount over the insured amount was free game for the two Cypriot banks to go to their depositors and say, hey, depositor, you've got $10 million in euros in our bank. Yes, the first 100,000, rest assured that's insured. Now let's talk about the 9,900,000 euros that remain.
Yeah.
Long story short, the haircut for those depositors was 50%. You woke up one day and you lost 50%. You were given, you thought you had 10 million euros. You really only had 5, and they gave you 5 million euros worth of new bank stock.
Yeah.
Well, nobody wants that.
No.
If I'm a Christian church that God is blessed with assets, growing congregation, da 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 da. You're out of your mind if you don't think a socialist, communist, progressive government is not, you don't have a target on your back.
Sure.
If you're a Christian family that, again, God's given you a lot of material wealth, don't be foolish. Mm. Get some of it off the grid by buying Bitcoin and buying physical gold.
Mm-hmm.
Push back. Well, they can. If they come after that, they'll come after this too. Okay, but did I buy you some time?
Yeah.
Did I buy you some time? Because the first thing they've got to worry about is, what are we going to do about all these accounts at J.P. Morgan?
Yep.
What are we going to do about all these accounts at Regions Bank?
Yep.
They're going to have bigger fish to fry first than some guy with $5 million or church with $5 million worth of Bitcoin.
Exactly.
They don't have time to fool with that yet.
Exactly.
They will. They'll get there. But if I've got time to move around, beforehand, I've at least done that.
Yes. It's the same argument. It's the same insane people who make the argument, oh, what is your Second Amendment going to do against the U.S. government? It's like, hey, go research the Vietnam War. Vietnam has way less guns than the South, let's say, for instance. And like, again, the United States wasn't able to take them. They weren't able to defeat them just because of the nature of, you know, an armed public. It's not as easy to take down as, you know, as people think that it is. And so it's a similar argument for gold. Like if they're not going to be coming after the people with, you know, again, the average person, $50,000 worth of gold. Like, I'm sorry, you're not even on their radar. It just doesn't even, and like people will go to Executive Order 6102 and they'll be like, look, what if they make it? It's like, listen, they were going after large institutions and like wealthy people. They weren't going door to door, like to try to get every golden nickel from every little, like that. It's just crazy. I think another thing that's really important that I'm like working on, you know, articles in, you know, basically a longer form piece as well to try to help people. Cause I think like the issue behind the issue underneath these issues is just how to properly think about government. And I think the average person just has a conception of government, like a Christian conception of government. The average Christian, when they think about government, boom, they run right to Romans 13. And they're like, listen, the government, like God has ordained the government. And so like they just uncritically suck that down and don't stop for a second to think about, wait, does this verse talk about the fact that governments can just create whatever reality on whatever front that they want to? And because they've got this magic blank check of Romans 13, it's just, they can just do whatever they want to. And it's like, well, obviously not. The Apostle Paul was put to death because he, you know, disobeyed the government. Right. And so I just think for the vast majority of Christians, they never, because they've lived in peacetime, they've been Christians in peacetime, yes, or what, yes, they thought was peacetime, they haven't really thought critically about like, but wait a second, where do we draw the line? And so I think something like COVID was a very helpful exercise in helping facilitate this conversation for a whole generation of people who hadn't had cause to think about it, or at least they didn't realize they had cause to think about it. And I think that, again, something like, we could talk about central bank digital currencies, even more, a lot of the things that you're talking about, like these are reasons why Christians should be thinking critically. The scriptures do have an incredible wealth of resources for how to think about situations like these. And we have dozens of examples of the people of God standing up against oppressive governments and insane governments that try to make themselves gods and try to force their citizens to treat them as, you know, all, you know, omnipotent gods. The scriptures have a bunch of examples of that. And we have examples of how the people of God answered. And it wasn't simply to, you know, genuflect while you quote, Romans 13. So I think that this is something that we really, the church really needs this conversation more than ever, at least in the American context. And I think that's something that's going to be, I'm encouraged, really, again, it's just like we see the same thing with Israel, right? Israel, the way that they woke up to reality and the way that they were really able to see what time it was through pain. And so for a lot of people, it's taken the events of COVID, or it's taken the events of, it's going to take the, you know, hyperinflation, or at least whatever you want to call the inflation that we're experiencing, which is really, if you're looking to anything of value, 15-20%. 10, 15, 20% over the last few years here, it's going to take that level of pain to wake them up to this reality. And you know, philosophy, as much as it pains me, is not going to be sufficient for the average person. It's going to take real world pain. And so again,
well, it always does.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always what's required.
Yeah, exactly. We're coming up on an hour mark here. So like for people who are, again, they're looking at this price. I mean, I've seen video of people from, I think New York City and then also other places around the world. There's long lines to the gold shop. People who are, I would imagine the vast majority of them are buying. I'm sure you have some insane people who are selling. Like they're looking at this and they're thinking, hey, this is good news. My gold, this gold coin or these gold coins that my grandfather left me have doubled or tripled in value. What would be your, you know, what you would say to these people beyond what you've already said?
Well, again, do not focus on dollar price, especially if you're a Bonson Ramsey Buffett guy and you hadn't gotten anywhere near this, you've got to rethink what we're really talking about.
Yep.
What we're talking about is, in Gold's case, since the dawn of God's creation in the Garden of Eden, this has been pointed out as a something he put in the creation that would be the standard of that would be a standard of value that has morphed into value all over the world from then to this day, where gold is actual money. What do I mean when I say that? I mean a unit of account, a medium of exchange, but also a store of value and a store of labor. You cannot say that about the U.S. dollar. Mm-hmm. You can't say it about the yen. You can't say it about the euro. You say, what do you mean? Well, isn't my labor stored there? Well, no, because it gets depreciated by the fact that there is no handcuffs on these government entities to prevent the flooding the supply of it.
Yeah,
because they do something else on the debt side, and all they're trying to do is balance the supply and the credits and the debits.
Yep.
Well, if I put all of my labor into a fiat currency, well, I'm going to get whatever that fiat currency does. And we know from the inception of the Federal Reserve in 1913, the U.S. dollar has lost 99% of its purchasing power. Whereas gold has not lost its purchasing power.
Yeah.
Bitcoin, the only issue I have with Bitcoin, at least right now, which doesn't mean it's always going to have that problem. You and I have talked about this, is that if I overlay Bitcoin's price performance with the NASDAQ price performance, I'm getting the same volatility statistics. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that's always going to be true. In fact, I am hoping and wanting to see Bitcoin zig when the NASDAQ zags, especially Bitcoin hold its value when the NASDAQ goes down 25%.
Sure.
That will be a great day.
Yeah.
But that's why I say, even for the Bitcoin maxi guy, I'm just saying, look, I'm not telling you to get out of that Bitcoin. Yeah. If your volatility appetite is great, yes, you should have more of it. Just don't have zero of gold.
Yeah.
And I would say to the gold guy, that's silly to say zero in Bitcoin, because it would be irrational to say that the advent of blockchain technology how he designed the thing was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And he did everything he was supposed to do to make essentially a intangible form of what gold actually is.
Yeah.
So why would you not want to own both of those? And my point to the wealthy church, again, I keep saying wealthy because those guys are the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
Not because I care about them more. Yeah. It's I want the small family that's got $5,000 to put into one gold coin. Mm-hmm. I want him to do that too.
Yep.
Or even less wealth to get silver.
Yep.
You know, do have something where you're not or small amounts, you know, 0.0005 of a Bitcoin.
Yep.
You know, get this stuff because you've got to do it The underlying reason is the same irrespective of what your wealth profile is.
Yeah.
But for the wealthy church and for the wealthy family or individual that is Christian, open your eyes. You are a target. Mm-hmm. Don't act like this has never happened. It has happened in the recent past in 2013, and it is on the books in the United States in the form of the Dodd-Frank law.
Yeah.
Go to Title II of Dodd-Frank. You will see there bail-in law.
Yeah.
So if you are over, and you know what a lot of people are doing too, oh, well, I'm going to get around that. I've got $10 million, so what I will do is I'll open 40 different CDs with 40 different banks. To which my response is, do you seriously believe that the FDIC, if we got into the situation where they had to provide the insurance, is going to pay you on 40 accounts? They're not going to do that. They're going to say, no, sir, you're a rich guy. Not going to.
That just betrays a lack of understanding of FDIC. Go do the deep dive on that one. It's not going to be there, at least in the way that they're saying it's going to be there. Yeah. And so this is, man, I would encourage you, go research gold. Again, this is something, go get some gold. Like, if this, it is something that makes sense, as like an insurance policy. This is what I tell people all the time. Like, this is something that makes sense to own. There are, because again, if for no other reason, then there are still tons of people in the United States who understand and value gold, and who are going to be, you're going to be able to use it to pay for things, you know, if something crazy happened. I think due to the monetary debasement, there's people have less and less money. And what they do have is bound up in things like their stock portfolios, or bound up within their homes. And so there's less and less people who do have, you know, a meaningful amount of liquid resources. But I do think that, you know, it is something that people need to take seriously. Because again, yeah, we live in insane times. when you have Treasury Secretary saying things like debt is just money we owe ourselves, you've entered into the crazy town. So, Jim, really appreciate your time. Actually, the one other thing I did want to push back on, and just in terms of the genesis, you know, the usage of gold, the one thing, and I didn't say this when we were talking, because when we had the debate, the thing that came to me afterwards was just thinking about, so that the way that I look at that was not, I don't read Genesis, I believe it's, is it one? Which is it, one or two?
Two.
Genesis 2, when it mentions that, I don't necessarily see that as like, this is God saying, that gold is, you know, that people should use gold. I look at that as, okay, so Moses, who wrote the Pentateuch, he's writing to a people, you know, however many thousands of years later after Genesis happens, like, he writes them and he's telling them, hey, he's like, hey, just so you know, because now by that point, gold actually is, like, gold's used pretty much ubiquitously in that time. And so he's just basically saying, hey, just by virtue of, just to let you know, like, you know, gold existed and it was back then and it was in this place. They had really good gold here. And so it's like, and so you could argue there's some relationship between that and kind of what you were arguing. But like, I think that, I mean, because again, I do think God, like, God created everything. And I think that God created gold to be used for this purpose. I read something that there's some scientists who think that all of the gold that exists on Earth came via this asteroid. And so, like, that's super interesting to me too. You know, like, God literally sent an asteroid with this thing that was proven to be the best money, that's existed on Earth. And so, yeah, so that would be one thing. But again, the broader point still stands. I think this is a good gift, a good tool that facilitates, just transactions between people, which allows societies to be built. This is another thing I point out, is that every civilization you would ever want to be part of has been founded upon scarce money at the very least, and in all the ones you would actually want to live in, gold. Gold and silver. And so to look at and think that we have arrived and we no longer need this dumb rock, I just think is chronological snobbery to the highest degree. It's not knowing what time it is. It's despising, it's breaking the fifth commandment. It's despising your fathers, which, you know, we know does not just apply to our, you know, physical, biological fathers. Do not fall prey to this. This is a danger, and I think that, you know, we would be fools to not take seriously the history and the way that gold has protected people from totalitarian governments and a whole host of other threats. So,
absolutely.
Jim, really appreciate you. Grateful for your friendship and for, you know, just your time coming on the podcast. Tell people where they can find more about you and ALP, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So ALPS, ALPS, as in the European mountain range. That name came from our original partners, which is Liechtenstein Precious Metals, built by two families from scratch. They purposely wanted to get out of the banking system. Mm-hmm. They did so, and they have their own vault, their own, all Lloyd's of London insured. So it's not like that you, oh gosh, I put it with these guys and never saw them again. That's not how it works. It is fully insured. If anything goes wrong or they do what they're not supposed to do, Lloyd's is, it will pay you, it will make you whole. The same for United States. Guys, my partner is Texas Precious Metals in the little town of Shiner, Texas, about halfway between San Antonio and Houston.
Yeah.
Christian family, the Caspers, built that from scratch. It is a state-of-the-art probably the state-of-the-art vault in the world right now. Mm. Trading, storage, all of that. We can. I was just there last week. The value amount of gold and silver that are in our vault now is $7 billion. There is no size that we can't handle. Mm-hmm. Institutional, family office, yep. or church. And again, that's my main message: is the churches have got to think about. They have to understand how God has made them. They have to understand we are in a fallen world where we have targets on our back, and we got to do something about it. So Alps Precious Metals Group, so the website www.alpspmg.com, or you just, the best way to get in touch with me is my telephone, 251-377-2197. It really is.
Yeah.
Because that's always on me, and it's easy to have conversations and
sure.
all the email back and forth. But all that's on the website as well. It's a very Spartan website on purpose.
Yeah.
We're not trying to get into competition with guys that are, that sell gold coins on the internet and stuff. I can and do and beat those guys in competition. Yeah. I just don't want to set it up that way. I think it's a very personal, especially when you're talking about a church elder board, that this is a personal conversation. Yeah. I need to have face to face with them. Or certainly a family office or individual, but I have small accounts too, all over the place where they bought 1,000, 2,000 silver coins. We will do that business too and beat what you could do on the internet.
Sure.
So hopefully we can add value as certainly to Christian brothers and sisters. And if they're not a Christian brother or sister, we can add value to those guys too.
Sure. Great. And so in just real quick on that front. So, I mean, there are these vaults, you know, there's a vault in Liechtenstein and there's also a vault in Texas. Is this something where like customers can like ask to take possession? Like if they want to get their gold, you know, sent to them or something like that, that's still an option.
Absolutely. Yeah. The nanosecond you ask for it.
Sure.
Compare and contrast. I have $1 million worth of gold in the vault.
Sure.
Jim, we want to take it out because we built our own vault. Fine. Do you want to pick it up or do you want us to ship it to you? Go try to get $1 million in cash out of any bank anywhere.
Yeah.
They will tell you no.
Yeah. And so you guys, with you guys, there's no rehypothecation. You guys are
zero.
Zero.
Okay. Zero. We are bailment custodians and we are paid a fee to take care of your gold and silver. Our job is to take care of it. We have no other job.
All right, cool. Jim, really appreciate you. And we will chat with you hopefully sometime in the near future here. Again, if we see gold get up to you know, those five-figure prices that you're presuming, we'll bring you back as a prophet and a son of a prophet. And and then, again, for the rest of the audience, go find some information from Jim and then go like, subscribe, and all these in all the different places to help other people find these resources. We're grateful for you, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Jordan. You're very kind, and it's, as I say, a true honor to be on your program.
Well, thank you.
You got it.